The two waves of running, screaming men met just below the break of the poop, were transformed into a struggling mass of closely locked humanity, and their cries and curses mingled with the animal howl of terrified slaves. The pistols and muskets had all been discharged, and there was no chance to reload. It was steel against steel now. Black Joke's crew were battle-hardened. They had fought together 50 times in the past year. They had stormed Glassies and Barracoon and withstood fire and steel. They were blooded fighting men and proud of it. Huron's men were commercial seamen, not warriors. Most of them had never swung a cutlass nor fired a pistol at another man before, and the difference was evident almost immediately. For a minute or two, the closely engaged mass of men swayed and churned like the meeting of two strong currents at the tidal line of the ocean, and then Black Joke's sailors began to forge forward. "Up the jokers!" they sensed their advantage. "Hammer and tongs, boys! Give 'em hell!" At only one point was the tide of British sailors checked. At the foot of Huron's mainmast, two men stood almost shoulder to shoulder. Tipu seemed immovable on the solid foundation of those massive bared legs. Like a Buddha carved from solid rock, he spurned the press of men around him, and their ranks parted and drew back. His loincloth was drawn up between his legs, and his smooth belly bulged over it, again as hard as mountain rock, with the deep cyclops eye of his navel in its centre. The golden thread of his embroidered gillet sparkled in the sunlight, and he held his great round head low on his shoulders as he swung a double-bladed axe as easily as though it were a lady's parasol, and the axe hissed fiercely at every stroke, and Black Joke's seamen gave him ground. A pistol ball had nicked the scarred flesh of his bald head, and blood poured copiously from the shallow wound, turning his face to a glaring, gory mask. His wide-toed slit of a mouth opened as he laughed and shouted his contempt of the men who swarmed about him like pygmies about an ogre. Beside him fought Mungo St. John. He had stripped off his blue jacket to free his sword arm, and his white linen shirt was open to the belt, the buttons torn from their threads by a clutching enemy hand. He had knotted a silk bandana around his forehead to keep the sweat from running into his eyes. But sweat poured down his naked chest and had soaked through his shirt in patches. He had a sword in his right hand, a weapon with a plain silver steel guard and pommel, and he cut and parried and thrust without a break in the rhythm of his movements. He was unmarked, the droplets of thrown blood that stained the full sleeve of his white shirt, and which had been diluted by his sweat to a dirty brown, were not his blood. "St. John!" Clinton called to him. They were both tall enough to look over the heads of the men between them, and they stared at each other for a moment. Clinton's eyes were pale, fanatical blue, and his lips white with fury. Mungo's expression was grave, thoughtful almost, and his gaze troubled, almost grieving, as though he knew he had lost his ship, and that his life and the lives of most of his crew were forfeit. "Fight me!" Clinton challenged him, his voice strident, ringing with triumph. "Again?" Mungo asked, and the smile touched his lips fleetingly, then was gone. Clinton shouldered his way roughly through the press of his own men. The last time it had been pistols, Mungo St. John's choice of weapon. But now Clinton had the familiar weight and balance of a naval cutlass in his right hand, his weapon, that he had first swung as a midshipman of 14 years old, and the whipcord muscles in his long right arm were seasoned to the use of the blade, and every evolution in its use, every trick and subterfuge, had been drilled until they were instinctive. As they came together, Clinton feinted and cut backhanded and low, going for the hip to cripple and bring the man down. As the stroke was parried, he felt the strength of Mungo's sword arm for an instant before he disengaged, and switched his attack fluidly, going on the thrust, leading with his right foot, a full stroke, and again the parry was strong and neat, but only just strong enough to hold the heavier, broader steel of the cutlass. Those two brief contacts were enough for Clinton to judge his adversary and find his weakness, the wrist. He had felt it through the steel, the way a skilled angler feels the weakness of the fish through line and rod. It was the wrist. St. John did not have the steely resilience that comes only from long and dedicated exercise and practice. He saw the flare of alarm in St. John's strangely flecked eyes. The American, too, had felt his own inadequacy, and he knew he did not dare to draw out the encounter. He must try to end it swiftly, before the Englishman's superiority could wear him down. With the swordsman's instinct, Clinton translated the little flicker of the golden yellow eyes. He knew that Mungo St. John was going on the attack, so that as the stroke came an instant later, he caught it on the broad curved blade of the cutlass. Then he shifted his weight forward, and with a twist of his own iron wrist, prevented the disengagement, forcing St. John to roll his own wrist, the two blades milling across each other, the steel screeching sharply on a harsh abrasive note that set their teeth on edge. Clinton forced two and then three turns, the classic prolonged engagement from which Mungo St. John could not break without risking the thunderbolt of the riposte, and Clinton felt the other's wrist give under the strain. He lunged his weight against it, slid the guard of the cutlass high up the blade, and used the rolling momentum of two blades and the leverage of his wrist and the curved guard of the cutlass to tear the hilt out of Mungo St. John's fingers. The American's sword clattered to the deck between them, and Mungo St. John threw up both hands, sucked in his belly, and flung himself back against the mainmast in an attempt to avoid the thrust of the heavy cutlass blade, which he knew would follow. In the fury of hatred that possessed Clinton, there was no thought of giving quarter to the man whom he had disarmed. The thrust was full-blooded, driven by all the strength of wrist and arm, of shoulder, and of Clinton's entire body weight, the killing stroke. Clinton's whole being had been concentrated on the man before him, but now there was movement in the periphery of his vision. Tipu had seen his captain disarmed at the same instant that he had just completed a swing with the axe. He was off balance. It would take only a shaded instant to recover that balance, to raise the axe again. But that instant of time would be too long, for he saw the cutlass stroke already launched, and Mungo St. John trapped helplessly against the mainmast, his belly unprotected and his empty hands held high. Tipu opened his huge paws and let the axe go spinning away, like a cartwheel, and then he reached out and seized the gleaming cutlass blade in one bare hand. He felt the blade run between his fingers and the terrible sting of the razor-sharp edge cutting down to the bone. Still he heaved with all his weight, pulling the point away from the helpless man against the mainmast, deflecting it but unable to hold it, for the tensed tendons in his lacerated fingers parted, and the blade ran on, driven by the full weight of the tall, platinum-headed naval officer. Tipu heard the point of the cutlass scrape over one of his ribs, and then a numbness filled his chest, and he felt the steel guard of the hilt strike his ribcage, a thud like that of a butcher's cleaver striking the chopping board as the cutlass blade reached the limit of its travel. Even the savage force of that blow was not enough to knock Tipu off his feet, though it drove him back a pace. He stood solidly, his eyes screwed up into slits of skin, staring down at the blade that transfixed his chest, his bleeding hand still clutching the guard of the cutlass. Only when Clinton leaned back and pulled the blade from his flesh did Tipu begin to sag slowly forward, his knees buckling, and he fell, his body slack and unresisting. Clinton freed his cutlass blade, and it was thinly smeared along its full length, so that it blurred redly as he went on to the forehand cut, going once more for the man who was still pinned against the mainmast. Clinton did not complete the stroke. He arrested it in midair, for Mungo St. John had been borne to the deck beneath a wave of struggling British seamen. Clinton stepped back and rested on his cutlass. The fight was over. All around him the crew of Huron were throwing down their weapons. "Quarter! For the love of God, quarter!" They were dragging Mungo St. John to his feet. two seamen on each of his arms. He was unwounded, and Clinton's hatred was unabated. It took an enormous effort to prevent himself driving the point of the cutlass into Mungo's belly. Mungo was struggling to throw off the hands of the men who held him, straining to reach the massive body of the half-naked Moslem mate that lay at his feet. "Let me free!" Mungo cried. "I must see to my mate!" But they held him remorselessly, and Mungo looked up at Clinton. "In the name of mercy," he was pleading. And Clinton had never expected that. He took a deep, ragged breath. The madness began to fade. "I give you my word, sir," Mungo was stricken. There was no mistaking his consuming grief. And Clinton hesitated. "I am your prisoner," Mungo told him. "But this man is a friend." Clinton let out his breath slowly, and then he nodded to the seaman who held Mungo St. John. "He has given his word," and then to Mungo, "You may have 5 minutes." And the seaman released him. Mungo sank swiftly to his knees beside the inert figure. "Old friend," he whispered as he tore the bandana from off his own head and pressed it to the obscene little slit between Tipu's ribs. "Old friend." Clinton turned away, slipping the cutlass back into its scabbard, and he ran across the deck to the weather rail. Robin Ballantyne saw him coming, and she strained towards him, unable to lift her arms for the slave cuffs that still bound her. But as he embraced her, she put her face against his chest, and her whole body trembled and shook as she sobbed. "Oh, I give thanks to God!" "Find the keys," Clinton ordered brusquely. And as the cuffs fell from Robin's wrists, he snatched them up and handed them to one of his men. "Use these on the slavers, Captain," he ordered. With that gesture, the last of his madness was gone. "Forgive me, Dr. Ballantyne. We will speak later, but now there remains much to be done." He bowed slightly and hurried away, calling his orders. "Carpenter's mate, go below immediately. I want the damage to the ship repaired at once. Bosun, disarm her crew, and have them sent below under lock and key with a guard on the companionway. 2 men on her wheel and a prize crew to work her. We'll sail her into Table Bay with the dawn, my boys, and there'll be prize money for your fancy." His men were still drunk on excitement and battle lust, and they cheered him hoarsely as they rushed to obey the string of orders. Rubbing her chafed wrists, Robin picked her way across the littered deck and through the throngs of bustling British seamen as they hustled their captives and the still chained files of slaves below. Almost timorously, she approached the ill-assorted pair at the foot of the ship's mainmast. Tipu lay on his back, the mound of his naked belly pressing upwards like a woman in labour, the soiled bandana hiding the wound. His eyes were wide, staring up at the mast that towered above him, and his lower jaw sagged. Mungo St. John held the huge, bald cannonball head on his lap. He sat with his legs thrust out straight ahead of him, his back against the mast, and as Robin approached, he closed the lids over Tipu's staring eyes one at a time with his thumb. His head was bowed, his hands gentle as those of a mother with her infant, as he lifted the bandana and used it to bind up the sagging jaw. Robin went down on one knee and reached out to Tipu's chest to feel for the heartbeat. But Mungo St. John raised his head and looked at her. "Don't touch him," he said softly. "I am a doctor." "He no longer needs a doctor." Mungo's voice was low and clear. "Especially if that doctor is you." "I am sorry." "Dr. Ballantyne," he told her, "you and I have no reason to apologize to each other, nor for that matter to speak to each other, ever again." She stared at him, and his face was cold and set. The eyes that stared back at her were devoid of all emotion. And it was in that moment she knew she had lost him, irrevocably and forever. She had thought that was what she wanted, But now the total knowledge left her devastated, without the strength to break her gaze, without the power of speech. And he stared back at her remotely, hard and unforgiving. "Mungo," she whispered, finding at last the strength and will to speak. "I did not mean this to happen. As the Almighty is my witness, I did not mean it." Rough hands dragged Mungo St. John to his feet, so that Tipu's dead head slipped from his lap and the scowl thumped against the wooden deck. "Captain's orders me, old cock, and you're to have a taste of your own chains." Mungo St. John did not resist as the slave cuffs were fastened on his wrists and ankles. He stood quietly, balancing to Huron's wild, gale-driven lunges, looking about the fire-blackened ship with its decks covered with fallen and tangled rigging, stained with the blood of his crew. And though his expression did not change, there was a limitless grieving in his eyes. "I am sorry," whispered Robin, still kneeling beside him. "I am truly sorry." Mungo St. John glanced down at her, his wrists fastened at the small of his back by the cold black links of chain. "Yes," he nodded. "So am I." And a seaman thrust the palm of a horny hand between his shoulder blades, shoving him away towards the Huron's forecastle, and the slave chains clanked about his ankles as he staggered. Within a dozen paces he had recovered his balance and shrugged off the hands of his jailers. He walked away with his back straight and his shoulders thrown back, and he did not look back at Robin, kneeling on the blood-stained deck.